Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast, the week of July 4th through 11th. This week, we spoke with David Courtwright, whose new book, Ending Obama's War, Responsible Military Withdrawal from Afghanistan, is particularly timely in light of the president's recent speech on military policy in Afghanistan, announcing a drawdown of American troops. I spoke to Professor Courtwright, who is the Director of Policy Studies at the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, just a day after President Obama's speech.
Maybe we could just begin by getting your reactions to President Obama's speech on Afghanistan last night.
I think it's important that the President has decided for a withdrawal process, and that he's picked a number of 33,000 that's a bit higher than was anticipated. So that's the good sign. The unfortunate fact is that it means the war will continue for a year or two or more beyond what it is now. And all of the costs and the violence and the suffering that comes with the war will continue. So it's not really satisfactory. If we really want to end the war, there needs to be a more substantial reduction. But I think more importantly, that there needs to be a series of other actions. A different strategy needs to be put in place. I mean, we're still essentially wedded to a war strategy, you know, which means conduct military operations, try to kill a lot of the enemy, and somehow force them to concede on our terms. I don't see that as working or having any chance of working. Instead, we ought to be attempting to end the fighting as quickly as possible, which would mean offer a bigger reduction, negotiate for a ceasefire, and for a comprehensive political and security agreement and arrangements inside Afghanistan itself. And that means, you know, getting the insurgents and the Kabul government to really talk seriously about how they're going to divide up power, what the security arrangements are going to look like. And we can help to guarantee that as we leave and support it, but there has to be a negotiated political solution. And so I would hope that the president is starting a withdrawal. That's good, but let's move it more quickly, and then let's really focus our attention on the ending of the fighting and the negotiation of a political and security arrangement.
Well, perhaps you could talk a bit about what some of the non-military options are, because I think kind of the American public is probably so conditioned to looking at this through a military lens. What else can we do other than send troops?
Well, lots of things. The political and diplomatic side is critically important. You know, we do have leverage because we have all of our troops there, and the insurgents want those troops gone, and most Americans now want the troops out. So what we can do is offer the process of withdrawal as an inducement to the insurgents to get their agreement on some key provisions. For example, maintaining the constitutional process that they have there now, getting their cooperation in suppressing Al-Qaeda and preventing the use of their territory for any more terrorist strikes. So all of that's part of a diplomatic process. And another key element of that is, why don't we organize a diplomatic contact group among the neighboring states? They all have a major stake in what's going on. India, Pakistan, of course, China, Iran, many states in the region. And we could work with them to get a united strategy by those states to ensure that nobody is going to intervene in Afghanistan, take advantage of it as it tries to recover from all this war. And secondly, that there's a process of stabilization in the region, which will be critically important for Afghanistan to get back on its feet. So that's a key part. There also are possibilities for providing alternative security arrangements. Because as the U.S. and other NATO forces leave, there could be a power vacuum, and that could be dangerous. So to guard against that, a number of people have proposed deploying some kind of an interim security force, a peacekeeping type force. Even Henry Kissinger wrote about this, and I mentioned it in his article recently in the Washington Post. He talked about the need for some kind of an enforcement mechanism to ensure that whatever negotiated agreements come up are actually followed. We've been advocating a UN-authorized peacekeeping or interim security force. Even the Taliban have proposed this idea, and they've talked about the need for a, quote, Muslim-led security force. So whatever the exact formulation, it's unclear, but some kind of an alternative security force I think would be necessary, and if it could have some significant Muslim leadership, as the Taliban have suggested, that might make it easier for the insurgents to accept it, and then probably for the local communities there in Afghanistan to accept it. And I think it could play a critical role in, as I say, avoiding a power vacuum and helping to ease the transition to Afghanistan taking full responsibility for its own security.
Now, you mentioned regional stabilization. Of course, you know, looming in the background here is Pakistan, and, you know, which is, of course, a nuclear state, and all the dangers that come with that. How does that play into this question, and how, you know, how we can kind of extract ourselves in a way that, you know, doesn't destabilize, you know, Afghanistan, but also kind of its relationship with Pakistan?
Yeah, as President Obama said during the earlier review of his policy, he said the cancer is next door in Pakistan, and it is true. There's more insurgency, more Al-Qaeda militancy over there on the Pakistani side, it seems, than in Afghanistan a lot of the time. And so, and we also have the problem that the Pakistani military, at least portions of it, and their security services, have been supporting the Taliban insurgency. Now, that's just a fact that we know, and it's not going to change. So I think that the Pakistani authorities, especially their military, they need to have a place at the table, a seat at the table in the negotiations that are going to be going on, that have already started between the Taliban and the Kabul government. Doesn't mean they should control it, but if they don't have at least some voice, and if their views aren't heard, then they have the potential to be a spoiler. And we've already seen that they've done this a couple times to arrest those who try to go to the negotiations. So they're going to have to play some kind of a role, and it's best to invite them in. And we also need them, of course, for this idea of a regional diplomatic stabilization process. So in many ways, Pakistan is very troublesome, but I think President Obama is right. We have to work with them for all the problems that they present, and especially give them some kind of a seat at the table as we engage in the diplomatic process.
Well, it seems like, as you know, Dan, no public opinion seems to be shifting on this question, especially since the death of Osama bin Laden. Is this sort of a moment to try to take advantage of that, to make a real change in policy?
No doubt about it. And I think that's one of the reasons why the president adopted a figure for the number of troops to be withdrawn that was higher than what the generals had proposed. And he, I think, felt that given the success in getting rid of bin Laden and the very obvious weakening that has taken place in Al-Qaeda in the region, that we're in a better position in terms of our security stance and our security interests to be able to pull the troops out. And many have urged, including Vice President Biden, that we shift away from counterinsurgency towards counterterrorism. And that means more targeted operations like the one that got bin Laden, really trying to focus police and security and intelligence pressure on the actual Al-Qaeda militants, who are the ones who are responsible for attacking the U.S., of course, and for launching attacks, terrorist attacks globally. Now, the Taliban, they're a dangerous force, but they're focused primarily on their own local community. They haven't been responsible for sending militants to attack the United States or other countries. Al-Qaeda has. They're the dangerous global threat, and let's focus on them. And that means counterterrorism, and you don't need a lot of troops for that. In fact, you don't need troops on the ground. You need good intelligence, good police work, cooperation with the host countries. And that is what we've done before in terms of getting bin Laden and what we need to do more into the future. And then that makes it not only possible but necessary to start to draw down the troops more rapidly, reduce and eventually eliminate our military footprint there in Afghanistan and northern Pakistan.
Now, you write in your book about the question of women and the status of women in Afghanistan and how this has been used by many people who are defending the war. The famous Time magazine cover suggesting what would happen if we left Afghanistan. Maybe you could talk a bit about what we could do to support women in lieu of having troops in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's a difficult but an important issue. We stand for human rights, and we don't want to see women thrown back to the Stone Age kinds of conditions, the brutal conditions that they faced under the Taliban government before 01. And women have made significant gains in having a voice politically in the country and also getting access to education and healthcare and economic income. But we can't help Afghan women by continuing a war. The violence hurts everybody, innocent civilians most of all, and we need to find a way to end the war. When we did our interviews over in Afghanistan with many Afghan women, every person said the most important thing is to end the violence, to increase security. Then we can truly exercise our rights. So that's an imperative for moving ahead with the withdrawals. But there are some other practical steps we can take to ensure that the women are not, so to speak, thrown under the bus as we head for the exits. One is to ensure that we continue to fund the proven development programs that have helped women to get education and health care and development opportunities at the local level. And those programs work, and they have nothing to do with the military. They're programs funded by the U.S. and the European Union and the World Bank and the U.N. They need to continue. The other thing we can do is ensure that women have a seat at the table in Afghanistan in the various peace committees and negotiation processes that are underway now. Afghanistan has a body now that's been created called the High Peace Council, and it's designed to provide political guidance for all the negotiations that are going to be underway that are already starting. Well, women need to be more meaningfully represented in that body. There's 70 members of it. Latest information I have is there's only 8 or 9 women there. So that obviously needs to change. And we have leverage still from the United States while our troops are there, and we ought to use it to make sure that women have a greater role in the High Peace Council and that they are definitely at the table in any of these negotiations that are talking about the future political shape of Afghanistan.
We started by talking about the troop numbers, and obviously that's an important point to consider. But is there some danger here that, you know, if we focus on, you know, how many troops are there and removing them, but there could be violence perpetrated by other means, including, for example, drone attacks. Is it possible that those continue even while the United States was pulling out of Afghanistan?
Yes, and it's worrisome because the administration interprets the strategy of counterterrorism to include these pilotless drone attacks, and they are, I think, counterproductive. Sure, they say they kill and incapacitate some of the terrorist organizers, but they also kill many civilians. They rely on or have to rely on intelligence by local people in the communities that are being attacked, and that's notoriously unreliable and inaccurate. And we know that the people in Pakistan and the Afghan government and practically every organized voice that we've heard from that region has loudly condemned these attacks. They are a form of terror. You think about it, you're just out there in a community, maybe some radical extremist comes through your community someday, and then you never know whether there's going to be bombs raining down from the sky coming out of nowhere. So it's a terror weapon, and I think that we need to just stop this policy altogether, sit back and reflect and think about the implications and the moral implications of waging war completely in a remote control fashion. The so-called pilots of these drone attacks, sometimes they're sitting over here in the U.S., maybe at an air-conditioned military base somewhere, and they're pushing buttons that are killing people over in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That does not meet any of the fundamental moral criteria that we talk about in terms of Catholic social teaching, just war doctrine. Under proper ethical standards, if there is to be military conflict, we have to take every precaution to ensure that any innocent lives are that all innocent lives are protected, that we don't take any innocent life. That's certainly not what happens when we're using these remote control drone attacks. You know, and yes, they have precision accuracy in terms of the technology, but again, that technology is fundamentally based on human intelligence, which is not reliable and cannot be precise.
These drone attacks have gone up, actually, as you know, underneath the Obama administration. You write in your book that you were an early supporter of Obama, in part because of his criticism of the Iraq War. But you also write that you've been disappointed with his policy in Afghanistan. Maybe you can end by talking about that.
Yes, I think the president was taking significant leadership in the campaign, and I think arguably was able to gain the advantage early in the campaign because of his unequivocal stance against the Iraq War. That's how he distinguished himself from Hillary Clinton and the rest of the Democratic field. And so he owes his election, to some degree at least, to his commitment to the anti-war position and the strength of that constituency in 08. Many of us then were very disappointed that he went ahead and escalated the war in Afghanistan. And I do think the president has a bit of a political problem with that core constituency. He needs to have that same group that helped to elect him in 08 mobilized, actively involved, sending money, knocking on doors, showing up at the caucuses, all of that. And frankly, many of us are unsure. We may yet vote for the president, but the more important question is, will we work for him? Will there be the degree of enthusiasm that he enjoyed in 08? And I think for him to capture that energy again, he has to show more leadership on that core issue. Now, he has fulfilled his promise to end the war in Iraq, and I'm hopeful and I expect that the last troops will indeed leave at the end of this year, and that's a great achievement for him, and we thank him for it. But we need him also now to end the war in Afghanistan, and he's started in that direction. He's made some positive gestures, but he hasn't gone nearly far enough. So I think the message from many of us to the president and to his campaign will be we need to see more of a commitment that you will end the war in Afghanistan the way you've ended the war in Iraq, and we want to see it happen sooner rather than later, because not only is it morally correct, it's necessary for our own country now. Everyone is focused on the economic costs, and the point that the president himself made last night is so true. We need to do nation building here at home rather than over there in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Well, David Courtwright, we want to thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.